This is a CBC podcast. Take a trip around the world with As It Happens. From the complex headlines of the day to the weird and wacky, As It Happens brings you the story behind the story. Download the podcast at cbc.ca/as-it-happens.
From the Haskell Free Library and Opera House, straddling the international boundary at Stansted, Quebec, and Derbyline, Vermont, so our head doesn't know where our tail is, or vice versa, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart MacLean!
Thank you very much. Well, it's the longest boundary line in the world, and we Canadians are proud of that, seeing as how it's the only one we have. You, and I'm speaking to the Americans here today, you have twice as many as we do, boundaries that is, and we managed to get in the record books with our only shot, over 5,500 miles long. That's nearly 9,000 kilometers if you speak the Queen's English. Boundary goes all the way back to 1783 and the Treaty of Paris, and it is still a work in progress. There's still a few spots along the back fence, like all neighbors, where we have our bones of contention, but no one seems too fussed about them. Well, okay, some people do. Dealing with matters like that, with these fussy bits, is the business of the IBC, the International Boundary Commission, an organization dedicated to fussiness. As for the rest of us, well, you can't get too fussed about a boundary line that creeps through a library and a tavern and a golf course and any number of homes that pre-existed the survey and straddle a boundary like park benches and a park bench and four airports. I could go on. It has been touted for years as the longest undefended border in the world, and we liked it that way. Before the guards began wearing sidearms. Although even with guns, it hasn't changed that much. Guards have always tried to look stern. They've always made you feel like you've come to ask permission to marry their daughter. When really all anyone wanted to do was to take her to the dance. Everyone knew that we'd all be home by dawn. We want to celebrate the border today, the boundary that both separates us and at the same time ties us together. And that's why we're here in the town of Stansted, Quebec, or Derbyline, Vermont, depending on which door you walk through. Part of the world where I am told it's 50% French, 50% English, and 50% you can't tell. The two towns are like siblings who have been farmed off to distant relatives, or more to the point, co-joined twins who surgeons are determined to separate. A geographer tell you they are contiguous, which means there's nothing between them, no way to mark where one ends and the other begins. But of course, there is that boundary line. They put gates right across Ball and Lee Street. And then there's Canusa. Canoose is actually bisected by the boundary, so that houses on one side of the street are in the USA and on the other are in Canada. And in these post-9/11 days, if you want to cross the street to visit a neighbor, you're expected to report to the appropriate customs house at the end of the street. If you don't, it's a $1,000 fine in Canada and a $5,000 fine in the States. And how about the water? Water which famously knows no boundary. They worked out that part years ago. Stansted and Derbyline share a water treatment system. Drinking water is pumped from Canadian wells and stored in an American reservoir. Derbyline sewage makes the trip back across the border for treatment. People living here do that all the time, slip back and forth for treatments. To fill their cars with gas, say, depending on the state of their respective dollar and the price of gasoline. It's a dance of sorts, living not close to, but right on the borderline. And more of a dance today than it used to be. Barriers disguised as flower pots went up at the end of Church Street last week. And there are sensors and cameras, and some people find the dance unnerving these days. They say it makes them feel like they're living on the edge of something. And no matter how people feel about the dance, they'll tell you that you have to be sure-footed, that's for sure. It's always a delicate matter, living close to the heart of things. But living close to the heart of things means you are also close to the heart of the matter. Well, nothing could be closer to the heart of the matter than the building that we're in today. Martha Stewart Haskell built the Haskell Free Library and Opera House in memory of her husband. Being of dual heritage, she wanted to create a place that would serve both Canadians and Americans. She foresaw border restrictions becoming an issue, and that's why she stuck it right on the boundary. When this building was built, and it was built more than a century ago, it was deliberately built to straddle the border. These days, that would be seen as a profoundly passive-aggressive piece of business. Actually, these days, you couldn't get away with it. I prefer to see it as a playful rather than a provocative place. Downstairs in the library, most of the books rest on Canadian shelves. There's actually a piece of tape on the floor that runs right through the reading room. Black stripe to delineate the Northeast Kingdom from Canada. So you can hop from Quebec to Vermont, as I did this afternoon, back and forth. An act of anarchy that both readers and writers have noted long before my arrival. Up here in the Opera House, most of the seats are in America, but the stage where I'm standing now is on Canadian soil. So that makes this the only theater in the United States without a stage. And the only library without books. You can read about it in Ripley's Believe It or Not. And what to make of all this? What to make of this little gem? Well, just this. This little gem of a place is the result of a coming together, not a coming apart. Things are always messy. And in the face of messiness, in the face of our differences, we are our best when we carry on. There is much business for us to do together, we neighbors. There are boundaries to be drawn and waters to take care of, rules and regulations to write and rewrite. And here in the Northeast Kingdom, there is this little opera house, designed over 100 years ago to be a border guard's worst nightmare. And against all odds, it is here still. And when things feel difficult or overwhelming or even impossible, it's worth reminding one another of that. I am delighted to be here today, and it is time for us to get on with the show. We have nothing to declare but the friendship and affection of good neighbors, linked together by tunnels and trains, bridges and planes, and of course, our stories. And that's what we're going to do on the show today. We're going to tell stories and play music, and it is my great pleasure now to welcome today's musical guest. And I've wanted to have this fella on the show for just about as long as this show has been on the radio. He was born in the southern United States, raised in Memphis, Tennessee. And you can hear the soft sounds of the South whenever he sings. But when I was a boy who was living in my hometown, living in Montreal, Quebec, as many young American boys did back then, I used to see him at the Yellow Door Coffee House. and at Rose's Cantina up at Morin High. Anyway, I don't see him much these days. Neither of us live in Montreal anymore. He's back in the States, which makes him a kind of embodiment of this border-hopping celebration. And for that alone, I'd be excited to introduce him to you today and to his music. But it is more than that. I'm excited because I believe him to be one of the great songwriters of his generation. I put forward, he stands shoulder to shoulder with people like Gordon Lightfoot and Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen and other border-hopping vagabonds of that caliber. He has written songs that people will be singing long after all of us are gone. And that is certainly one acid test of great art. Ladies and gentlemen, Jesse Winchester.
Thank you very much.
I lived with the decent folks in the hills of old Vermont. Well, what you will do all day, well, that depends on what you want. And I took up with a woman there, although I was still a kid. And I smile at the sun to think of all the loving that we did. She rose each morning and she went off to work, and she kept me with her pay. And I was making sweet love all night and playing the soul guitar all day. I had apple cider and homemade bread that would make a man kneel down to say grace, and clean linens on our bed and a warm feet fireplace. Yankee lady is so good to me. Yankee lady, just a memory. Yankee lady, you were so good to me, but your memory will have to do for me. An autumn walk on an old country road with a million flaming trees, and I was feeling a little uneasy because there was winter chilling the breeze. And she said, oh, I look, Jesse, look over there. I see birds and they're all southward bound. And oh, Jesse, boy, I am so afraid we're going to lose all this love that we have found. Yankee lady, you're so good to me. Yankee lady, just a memory. Yankee lady, you were so good to me, but your memory will have to do for me. Well, I don't know just what called to me, but boy, I know our plane had to go. And I left that little old Vermont town with a lift down to sunny Mexico. Oh, now. And now when I can see my old self as a stranger by my birth, when the Yankee lady's old memory can remind me of my worth. Yankee lady, you were so good to me. Yankee lady, just a memory. Yankee lady, you were so good to me, but your memory will have to do for me.
Jesse Winchester. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories and they have to be short, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us, and we'll read some of our favorites on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we'll send you a copy of our latest book, Revenge of the Vinyl Cafe. A story today from Hugh Franks of Toronto, Ontario, who reaches back 50 years for this story. Further, really, for this story is an echo from the days when the border was a contentious and even perilous place. Dear Stuart, writes Hugh, Saturday, October 13th, 1962, was the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Queenston Heights. And we had been invited to Niagara-on-the-Lake to participate in the celebration of General Brock's victory and death in that momentous battle of the War of 1812. We were two training vessels stationed in Toronto. We slipped HMCS York early Friday afternoon for the crossing of Lake Ontario. My participation was part of my two-week annual training, a requirement for those of us who had graduated from university but remained active in the Naval Reserve. Along with me was my friend Peter Jones, a fellow young lieutenant of stalwart character. The weekend program included a black tie dinner on the Saturday night. One of the guest speakers at the dinner was a professor of history from the University of Syracuse. In his opening remarks, the professor read from a press article, an article which reported that an American flag had been raised on General Brock's monument the very night before. I turned to Peter Jones and declared, "We must retaliate. We must redeem our nation's honor." We hatched a plan. Our plan was to raise the Canadian flag over the American Fort Niagara. The dinner continued late, and Peter and I stayed the course. Then we proceeded back to our ship. En route, we borrowed a large Union Jack being flown as part of the next day's parade. Prior to boarding, we investigated the local yacht basin for an appropriate craft to cross the river. We found a small punt chained on shore with its oars in place. Back on board our ship, we appealed to the chiefs and POs for a loan of dark trousers, sweaters, toques, shoe polish for our face, rope and hook, and most important, a hacksaw. Once suitably attired, we returned to the punt and proceeded to saw away at the chain. We noted the hour of our departure was 2:30 a.m. the exact time the Americans made their crossing 150 years earlier to the day. We, of course, were going the opposite direction. We were invading the United States. We made the U.S. side upstream from Fort Niagara and drifted quietly, hugging the riverbank. Just before the fort, we found, much to our glee and excitement, a Coast Guard facility. And there, centered in the U-shaped barrack facing the river, a magnificent 80-foot flagpole, stays and all. It was too good to resist. And so we moved to Plan B. Instead of scaling the 20-foot wall of Fort Niagara, we pulled into the slips of the Coast Guard base. Although it was now close to 3 a.m., we were confronted with two challenges. One, the courtyard was brightly floodlit. Two, hard as it is to believe, we could hear voices. Personnel, wide awake, with an open window to their room. We had to move fast. We decided to secure the flag in such a way that once aloft, it could not be lowered. So we raised it with one halyard. As we did, the masthead pulley squeaked loudly, making an incredible racket. But we got it up, and once it was, we scurried across the grounds over the side into our punt, and we slipped down the coastline, hugging the shoreline in the shadow of the floodlights. I stopped rowing to listen for voices. Nothing. So far, so good. As we were pulling away from the shore, however, we noticed, much to our horror, two huge searchlights mounted on the wall above us. Our hearts pounded as we rowed into the open, but the lamps remained dark, and we made it safely back to our ship and bunked in. Mission accomplished. The following day, late in the afternoon, as we slipped out of harbor and bid farewell to Niagara-on-the-Lake, the order came, "Attention on the upper deck, face to port." Acting as forecastle officer that day, I ordered my crew to face starboard, and we all turned and saluted the Union Jack, flying proudly on the American shoreline, undisturbed. A successful weekend and the nation's honor intact. The story came to us from Hugh Franks of Toronto, Ontario. Is Jesse Winchester.
Thank you. This one is a little summertime number. The boys will sing shingling the summer night we met. You were 10 and 17. Oh, how could I forget? When every star from near and far was watching from above, watching two teenagers fall in love. The way we danced was not a dance, but more a long embrace. We held on to each other and we floated there in space. And I was shy to kiss you while the whole wide world could see. So shing-a-ling said everything for me. And oh, the poor old folks, they thought we'd lost our minds. They could not make heads or tails of the young folks' funny rhymes. But you and I knew all the words, and we always sang along to old Shamaling Dong Ding, Shamaling Dang Dong. So after years and after tears and after summers passed, the old folks tried to warn us how our love would never last. And all we'd get was soaking wet from walking in the rain and singing Shama Shingaling again. Oh, the poor old folks, they smile and walk away. But I bet they did some shamalama ding dong in their day. I bet that they still close their eyes, and I bet they sing along to old shamaling dong ding, Shamaline Dame. How those sweet old love songs, boy, every word rings true. Shamaling dong ding means sweetheart, and shamaling dang dong does too. And it means that right here in my arms, well, that's where you belong. And it means shamaling dong ding, shamaling dang dong.
Jesse Winchester. He'll be back. We're here today in this wonderful old theater straddling the border, celebrating the boundary that joins our countries. Dave, having grown up in Big Narrows and Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, grew up with certain ideas about these things, about borders and customs and paying duty and things like that. Whole town of Big Narrows had a certain laissez-faire attitude to these things when Dave was a boy. So it would have been hard for him to have thought any differently. Everyone, and I mean everyone from Chief Matson to Father McHale were born and bred, died in the wool smugglers. A habit, no doubt, left over from Prohibition days and possibly from before. Just as their ancestors worked ships full of rum down the main coast of Boston Harbor, so they too slipped back and forth across the border. And if they went by road instead of by sea, and if they moved their contraband into Canada instead of out, the underlying intention was the same. They were ducking duty. Paying duty seemed pointless. Duty was for other guys. The most favored port of call when Dave was a boy was Bangor, Maine. Still is. To this day, people from the Narrows make pilgrimages to the malls of Bangor. It's a 9-hour drive. Now that seems like a long way to travel for a pair of pants. Think of it as a migration. They can't help themselves. The urge to shop lands upon them, and off they go. Some of Dave's earliest memories involve trips to Bangor. Trips home were always in the dark. Dave and his sister Annie would lie in the back of their dad's old country squire, one of those big boat-like station wagons. There's probably an unconscious connection there to the ships, I mean, and to the rum runners who sailed them. They would cruise along Highway 2 like a clipper ship. Annie and Dave in the back curled up in their sleeping bags, each of them cradling 4 bottles of rye. Their job was to convince the border guards they were asleep. And if they did, and they always did, they got $1. Dave was in grade 1 when he was fully initiated into this world. Somebody was getting married, and Margaret and her friend Winnie were hitting the outlet store in the mill in Lincoln, Maine. Margaret told Dave he was coming with them. "Wear your hockey sweater," said Margaret. It was a strange request for June morning. But you did what you were told back then. While his mother and Winnie went to the mill, Dave wandered around Woolworth's basement, staring wistfully at the hamsters and the budgies. He was waiting on the sidewalk, like they told him, an hour later. About 15 miles before the border, Winnie pulled off the highway into a wooded picnic ground. She parked right at the back, out of sight of the road. They barely rolled to a stop, and Winnie was out of the car and was ripping their packages open. And while she did that, Margaret unbuttoned her blouse. Dave watched all this in astonishment. His mother taking her blouse off, tying sheets around her waist, and stuffing pillowcases into her bra. When she finished, she motioned to him. "Take off your sweater," she said. That afternoon, in his first true act of citizenship, Dave wore 5 lacy bras across the border. Dave eventually learned that Winnie's picnic ground was a regular stop for the citizens of Big Narrows. You could pull in there any time, day or night, and likely as not find some kid from the Narrows scuffing up a new pair of sneakers. So when Dave turned 8, and he'd saved a little money of his own, it seemed only natural that he would hold on to it for the next trip to Bangor. By the time they went, Dave had $12 burning a hole in his pocket. He knew exactly what he was going to get. He went right to Woolworth's and picked up a box of candy bars and his first ever watch. The watch was a Timex. The candy was 3 Musketeers. They were advertised on the Howdy Doody show, and you couldn't get them in Canada. Kids in Big Narrows would do anything for a bite of a 3 Musketeer. On the way home, they stopped at the picnic ground to straighten up, as Charlie put it. As they got ready to leave, he rested his arm on Dave's shoulder. "Remember," he said, "you can declare the candy, but don't mention the watch." Made Dave feel grown up. Also made him nervous. And when he saw the guard in his uniform standing beside the little customs booth, a rogue wave of guilt washed over him. His parents had always taught him to obey the law. This suddenly seemed so wrong. As his father inched toward the hut, Dave started sweating. By the time they rolled to a stop, he was weeping softly. The guard bent over and peered into the car. Now, Charlie was a master at this game. Charlie was one of the best in town. Why, Charlie used to take lint from the dryer with him on these trips and would use it to line the pockets of any new pants they bought. That's how good Charlie was. So when Charlie rolled down his window and the guard said, "Do you have any drugs or alcohol to declare?" Charlie, who happened to have 160 ounces of rye under the front seat, nodded at the kids in the back and he said breezily, "If I did, don't you think I would have used it up by now?" That sort of line usually worked like a charm. Unfortunately, Charlie's charmed life was about to end. Charlie had finally met his match, because this guard had long ago learned that if there were kids in the car, he should ask the kids to tell him about their trip. He had long ago learned that little ones inevitably rat their parents out. I feel like I'm not telling you anything you didn't already know. Nodding absent-mindedly at Charlie's little joke, the guard stuck his head in the front window and looked Dave and Annie up and down. As he did, a smile creased his face. He had a feeling. And when he had a feeling, he was seldom wrong. He barely hesitated. He looked right at Dave and he said, "Nice watch, son." Charlie, who was sitting in the front seat, let out a long, slow exhalation. "I got it in Bangor," blurted Dave, "but my dad told me not to declare it." The guard beamed at Charlie. "Gotcha," he said. But he said it quietly, so only Charlie would hear. That was the last time either Charlie or Margaret asked the kids to lie, and the last time they lied in front of the kids. From then on, when they went to Bangor with Dave and Annie, they only brought back what they were allowed. Though Dave did notice that if they went without him, they seemed to come back with a lot more stuff. As for Dave, well, ever since that horrible afternoon, Dave has declared everything he has ever bought at any border crossing he's ever crossed, right down to every last pack of gum, making him perhaps the only person raised in Big Narrows who has ever paid duty without duress. He followed the rules, though I would be lying if I didn't tell you that he didn't wonder from time to time if he couldn't, you know, make an exception every once in a while. And knowing that, you might understand what went wrong this summer, the last time he visited the United States with his family. They went to Saratoga Springs, New York, went for the weekend. Dave and Morley, Sam and Stephanie, they went to see a show. Dave's old friend, Bobby Kugel, the promoter, called and said they should come. He'd arranged backstage passes and everything. Bring everybody, said Bobby. And they had a grand time, hung out for sound check. And on Sunday, before they came home, they went to the mall. Of course, everyone went over their limit. And so as they rolled north towards the border, they all knew there'd be a stop so they could declare their purchases. Because that's the way Dave did it. After lunch, Morley gathered all the bills into a pile in her lap and she began adding them up. It added up to way more than Dave had imagined. Way more. As he drove along, Dave was trying to figure out the duty in his head and just how much that meant they had spent when you added in the hotel bill and the gas and the food and exactly how much there was in his checking account. Their little weekend jaunt, those free tickets, had actually been an extraordinarily expensive escapade. That's what he was thinking when he spotted the picnic ground. And he was seized by a spasm that he will never understand. He saw the sign, and at the very last moment, he jerked the wheel and he took the exit, leaving the highway with a squeal. And he rocked to a stop beside a picnic table behind the outhouses. And he looked at his surprised family and he said, "Okay, everyone out." "What's going on?" said Sam. Well, Dave was already out himself. Dave was already out of the car. He'd already popped open the trunk, and he was already unloading the packages, and now he was sitting at the picnic table, tearing them open and pulling off price tags. "What's going on?" said Sam again, staring at his father in amazement. Dave didn't answer. Truth of it was, Dave didn't know. Maybe something had awoken the rum runner spirit of his ancestors, or maybe he was reaching for the carefree spirit of his father, or maybe it was something more prosaic. Maybe the prospect of his looming visa bill had driven the caution from his soul. Whatever it was not about to put itself into words. All he said was, "Come on, come on," he said. They'd never seen him like this. And truthfully, it scared them a bit. But they all did as they were told. They took turns in the outhouse, slipping out of their old clothes and into their new ones. "Come on," he said again, holding out a pair of pants to Sam, just like his father had held out things to him. "I already have pants," said Sam. "Put this pair on over," said Dave. Then he lined them up, and he checked them, and he pronounced them ready. And they all waddled back to the car, walking like pudgy summer snowmen. And off they set. They were 5 minutes from the border. Before they climbed into the car, Dave collected all the empty bags and stuffed them into one. As they pulled out of the picnic grounds, he rolled down his window and tossed the bag of bags toward the garbage bin. He looked left, and he looked right. The highway was clear. He felt an odd sense of liberation. Everyone else felt confused, anxious, and hot. The customs officer waiting for them in front of the little booth looked incredibly young. He was, in fact, 22 years old, fresh out of college, fresh from 16 weeks of training in interrogation and interviewing. This was his first posting. This was his first Sunday night. The training had been incredible. He had listened while senior guards shared their war stories. He had role-played scenarios. He had worked as a secondary and watched primaries unravel people. And he had been at it 2 weeks now, and he hadn't made a single bust. And the older guys were beginning to rag him. He looked at Dave and waved him forward. As the car inched toward him, he sighed. Another family back from the malls. There'd be no glory in catching someone with another pair of undeclared sneakers. He was looking for real contraband. Dave was grinning up at him now. To be honest, it was more a leer than a grin. A little alarm began ringing deep in the guard's subconscious. "Good evening, sir," he said. "Any drugs, alcohol, or tobacco in the vehicle?" "Why," said Dave, trying to affect the breezy attitude of his father, "what do you need?" The young guard frowned. The alarm was ringing louder now. His spidey sense had begun to tingle. He looked Dave up and down, and he said, "That's a nice sweater you got there, sir. I've been looking for one like it. Where did you get it?" "Got it for my birthday," said Dave. "My mother gave it to me. She lives in Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, actually," and Dave's story was getting way too complicated. And it would have been much more believable had there not been a price tag dangling from Dave's neck. The guard held up his hand. He looked into the car. The whole family was wearing several layers of clothes. He sighed. He was tempted to let them through. He wanted more than a family of Judy Dodgers, and they all looked like they were suffering enough. And that's when he saw the bag of bags hooked on the back antenna. There was something about this that didn't add up. At school, they had been told the famous story about the old man and the wheelbarrow. The old man lived on one side of the border and worked on the other, which meant he crossed the border every day. And every day when he crossed, he pushed a wheelbarrow full of sand in front of him. Every day, the guards sifted through the sand, but they never found anything, nothing. On his last day of work, on the day of his retirement, the guards took the old man aside and they said, "We've known you for 25 years. And for 25 years, we've known that you've been smuggling something in the sand. But we've never been able to figure it out, and it's been driving us crazy. This is your last day. Please tell us what you've been smuggling." Well, the old man looked them up and down and he smiled. "Thought it was obvious," he said. "I've been smuggling wheelbarrows." The guard could feel his heart accelerating. He looked at Dave, at the obvious layers of clothes, at the sweater with the price tag, and now at the bag of bags. Nobody could be this bad. It had to be a diversion, a distraction, a bunch of wheelbarrows full of sand. The guard said, "Could you step out of the car, sir?" For the second time in his life, Dave was marched into the customs building and taken into a small room. Dave was thinking his goose was cooked. He was thinking there wouldn't just be duty to be paid, there were going to be fines, maybe even some sort of record. As the young guard watched him, he began to get excited too. The guy was clearly unraveling. What could possibly be in the car to make him so agitated? Alcohol? Cigarettes? Guns? Whatever it was significant, that was for sure. It was probably drugs. He was about to make his first big bust. If he played this right, there would be a press release. If he was lucky, he might get quoted in the paper. He went into the room. He sat in the chair facing Dave. He said, "Is there something you want to tell me?" And that's all it took. Just like that, Dave began spilling his guts. Wait a minute, said the guard. He'd start by asking where the drugs were. "Where are the goods?" he said. "They're on my person," said Dave. "Where?" said the guard. Dave thought of the shoes, the two pairs of pants, the five pairs of socks he was wearing. "Most of the contraband is below the waist," he said. So much for dinner, thought the guard. "This your first time?" he asked. "I was busted when I was a kid," said Dave. "Mostly I learned from my parents. My mother used me as a mule." "My wife has some on her too," said Dave. "But my kids are carrying most of it." As the guard stood up, Dave added one last thing. I guess I should tell you about the stuff we ate." It was Dave's first cavity search. When they were done with him, they went over the car with a fine-tooth comb. They didn't find anything but the clothing, of course. And Dave finally managed to convince them that there was nothing to find. "I swear to God," said Dave, "you got it all." But all the same, they were there for 3 hours. And somehow in the confusion, somewhere between the unpacking and the repacking, between the listing of their purchases and the checking of their IDs, the actual paying of the duty was forgotten. "Well," said Dave as they drove away, "that worked out well." No one else said anything. Until 5 minutes later, when Sam showed them the turtle. "I found him when we stopped at the picnic ground," he said. "A northern red belly, protected under the Endangered Species Act." The turtle had apparently slept through the search. "He was in the box with a board game," said Sam. Dave nearly had a heart attack. "But I didn't buy him," said Sam. "He didn't cost any money." "We could drive back," said Sam, "and we could come back through customs and declare him." Morley turned to the back seat and smiled sweetly at her son. "Declare that we've just brought a protected species across an international border? We don't need to tell them that, sweetie. They don't mind that kind of thing at all." Dave's only response was to step on the gas. Thank you. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank our special musical guest, Jesse Winchester, everybody. David Amer is the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Greg DeClute and Bill Herault were the recording engineers. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean, and we're going to let Jesse Winchester sing us out. I love this song, the chorus and the verses, and especially the line that comes halfway through that perfectly sums up our coming together today, here in this theater straddling the international boundary. Me, I want to live with my feet in Dixie and my head in the cool blue north. I'm Stuart McLean. So long for now.
Life is just too short for some folks, and for other folks it just drags on. Some folks love the taste of smoky whiskey, and others think your tea is too strong. I'm the type of guy that likes it right down the middle. Boy, I don't like all this bouncing back and forth. Oh no, I want to live with my feet down in Dixie and my head up in the cool blue north. In a small suburban garden where not a single neighbor knows our name, I know the woman wishes we would move someplace where the houses aren't all the same. Oh, Jesse, I wish you would take me where the grass is greener. I couldn't really say where that may be. I know it's someplace high up on a mountaintop, or it's down by the deep blue sea. Ooh, and there we are. We will do just as we please. Why, it ain't, it's nothing but a breeze. Oh, now, and one day I'll be old great grandpa, and all the pretty girls will call me sir. And now, where they're asking me how things are, well, soon they'll ask me how things were. Well, I don't mind being an old great grandpa as long as you be my great grandma. Yes, but I wish we would move with our tea and cookies to the shade of the old pawpaw. Ooh, and there we are. We will do just as we please. Why, it ain't, it's nothing but a breeze. Oh, now, life is just too short for some folks, and for other folks it just drags on. And some folks love the taste of smoky whiskey, and others think your tea is too strong. Well, I'm the type of guy that likes it right down the middle. Boy, I don't like all this bouncing back and forth. Me, I want to live with my feet on down in Dixie and my head up in the cool blue north. We do it.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.